Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Welcome everyone to this DMI podcast with James Wallace of Ripple on the case for CBDCs around the world. I'm John Orchard, Omfit CEO. James is CBDC leader at Ripple, which is a leading blockchain-based cross-border payments network. And the potential applications of this technology come up, of course, in every discussion we run, either on CBDCs or indeed more broadly about payments. And James has been working on blockchain for 7 years, having advised many fintech startups working with it. Before that, having been COO and co-founder of IBM's blockchain business, with global responsibility for market development, client engagements, sales, and business operations across all industry sectors. And James has in fact been in the payments industry for well over 20 years. So welcome, James, and thank you for joining us. Let's have a quick tour around the first principles, which I think are well worth revisiting. Tell us, what is CBDC? Why is there so much interest in CBDCs right now? And what's driving that interest?
Well, thanks, John. And firstly, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to doing this with you today. CBDCs, as you said, is a big topic. You can't open up your web browser and Google without seeing something about CBDCs. Really, it's a pretty basic principle, right? A central bank digital currency is essentially a digitized version of fiat or national currency. That's at its basic level. Think about it as a digital dollar as opposed to a physical dollar. And of course, with digital assets, you can do a lot more things than you can with physical assets. You can do, you can send things to people more easily, more quickly, more with less friction. So, big topic. But why has it suddenly become, very popular? I would say CBDCs as a topic has been talked about for probably 2 or 3 years. There's been lots of experimentation. In fact, there's still a lot of experimentation going on. I think over 80% of the central banks around the world are doing something in some shape or form. I think maybe we'll talk a bit later about, the difference between experimentation and making things a reality, because I think that's what we need to focus on.
We've often found talking about CBDC with central banks, the more you think about it, the harder it gets. Certainly they were driven towards it, I think, by a mixture of push and pull factors. On the one hand, technology looks interesting. There are all sorts of potential to improve financial inclusion and so forth. On the other, there was potential disruption from stablecoin issuers and so on. And we'll come on to that. Now, tell us what Ripple is doing specifically in the CBDC space and who you're working with.
We studied this for a while and talked to a lot of central banks. During our core business of our RippleNet, our cross-border payment business, we have to talk to central banks and we have to get approvals for our payment network in most countries. At the end of the day, the banks said, look, we don't want to use a public blockchain. We want to have control using a private blockchain, but we do see some value in working with the private sector. So, we decided to take some of the technology that we have, the RippleNet, and some of the public blockchain technology that we use with the XRP ledger, and we created a private CBDC ledger. So it's a distributed ledger based on blockchain, but it can be run and managed by a bank, central bank, and those trusted parties, such as commercial banks they want to work with. Specifically, we've got a number of projects on the go. There are two that are in the public domain so far. One is in Bhutan, which is a small country in the Himalayas, where they have a big agenda driven by His Majesty the King to drive innovation and to drive digitization in the country and also to foster financial inclusion. So we have a project there. It's in the pilot stage where we've developed a use cases around both wholesale CBDCs and retail CBDC. And in fact, it's also cross-border. So it kind of ticks all the boxes from our point of view. We expect to, in the first half of next year, to go into a live production environment on a limited basis. So that's a classic CBDC. My remit also sort of covers government currencies. And the distinction there is that there are some governments, some countries that don't have their own currency. So the other one that's in the public domain is Palau, which is an island nation in the Pacific. It's a dollarized country, but they're looking to develop their own currency or their own identity, but still keep it pegged to the dollar. So in that instance, the project is to develop a national stablecoin, which will be pegged to the US dollar. And there's lots of interesting use cases around that. But those are two examples that we're working on right now, John.
Well, that sounds like a very interesting experiment, that last case. A lot of people are expecting it to work the other way round, where major currencies will squeeze out smaller ones as CBDC becomes dominant. So that's actually, in a sense, the reverse case there. So that's well worth thinking about. I think you're also working with the Digital Pound Foundation in the UK, for example, as well. You're also involved in some of the developed world central banks too, and the considerations.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Digital Pound Initiative, I think, is a great initiative that's just got launched. We do tend to work with different sort of agencies and groups around the world. I think the policy side of this equation is of equal importance to the technology. So we're trying to spend our time equally on the policy agenda as well as the technology agenda.
We keep finding very different responses in the surveys that we do between developed and developing markets. That's not surprising in many ways, but it is also important. What do you see as the potential economic benefits and risks for both advanced economies and developing economies? Are there the different use cases in both cases and different levels of interest in those two areas?
Yeah, I think there's, if you look across the whole spectrum of countries, there are certainly different drivers, right? Some it's efficiencies, some it's innovation and competition, some of it's control. I think for the smaller economies, having a digital currency that they can use, I think will drive a lot of efficiency. You know, in countries like Palau, for example, they are subject to the whims of the card companies and the banks in terms of fees, right? Point of sale fees and cross border fees. So I think with digital solutions, those can be driven down significantly. If you take the case of Bhutan, financial inclusion is a big topic, and whilst the country is blessed in having a fairly wide penetration of mobile phones, the financial literacy is not as high as it could be. So, the people want to get access to, they say, small loans, for example, right, or even P2P loans. So we're even sort of venturing into the whole world of DeFi now as well, into some of the emerging economies around helping people get access to money. I think on the other end of the scale, the big economies, it's about sort of financial muscle power, I think. If you take the US and the European Central Bank in the Eurozone, they're keeping a very close eye on what's going on in China, around the digital yuan. And, is that a threat to the US dollar or the euro, in terms of global trade? So I think it's horses for courses. I think there are some sort of common themes. I think efficiency is definitely one. But I think I personally think the biggest one is innovation. I think as these platforms get rolled out, for different motivations, they will become a platform for new use cases. And I think anyone that drags their feet here, could potentially lose out. So I think speed is of the utmost here. Although I think as I demonstrated, I think the bigger countries find it difficult to get their way through the equation. Right? There's so many people that have an opinion, so many people get a vote, if you like, and there's so many competing parties that, the US will probably be a little bit slower than some of the other major economies, in my estimation, because of that political and complex economic environment.
We think exactly the same in here exactly the same. I want to touch again on the efficiency point you mentioned. We know that one of the reasons central banks are looking at CBDCs is to help shake up the payments arena. They don't want to disrupt banks too much. There is financial stability risk there that they're mindful of, but they are interested perhaps to make transactions more efficient, potentially cheaper, support financial inclusion, which you've mentioned as well. How can CBDC stimulate growth in emerging economies then by removing friction around payments?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at payments in its broadest sense, which includes a lot of cash payments made in those economies. In fact, there's a lot of cash used in some of the major economies as well. But if you take the emerging economies, just moving money around is very slow and complex. There are lots of examples of people moving physical money from like one place to another. you know, which you can do with, you know, much quicker, much lower cost, you know, it, digitally, right? I mean, I think one of the use cases in the Bahamas with the sand dollar is the ability to people to pay each other or send money to each other across the different islands, right? Whereas before, when it was more of a cash-based environment, that's obviously timely and costly. I also think there's, if you look at some of the emerging economies, they have a huge small and medium business, a lot of very small family-run businesses, I think could also benefit from a digital currency, you know, getting paid more quickly and getting paid on time or getting paid the full amount rather than someone taking a percentage off for a fee is meaningful to those, you know, those businesses. And I think as well, as we move forward, you know, with DeFi and the ability to, for maybe organize people that don't have access to credit to get access to new forms of credit, they can actually start growing their business. So I think ultimately these things can bubble up, and there could even be, you know, a macroeconomic benefit to some of the developing economies.
The discussion about CBDCs, in our experience, goes very quickly from the political to the technical and back to the political again. And certainly there seem to be some geopolitical implications, potentially for global trade here. What are these, do you think, and how big are the stakes, James?
Yeah, it's a big question. I think the stakes are pretty big. It depends a bit who you talk to. I've talked to a number of economists in the US about this. And there is a genuine fear, you know, for the US dollar in particular, that could be impacted by, you know, Silk and Road, you know, the initiatives in China around, you know, expanding their supply chain with the digital yuan. That's a real concern. I think the same concern is shared within the European zone. I think also in Japan, from my understanding. So I don't know where it's going to end up. I mean, clearly, you know, the US is dominant in terms of global trade now. That's probably not going to last forever, right? Nothing ever lasts forever. So I think just putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, you know, the dollar's going to remain dominant is not a sensible strategy. There's going to need to be some form of coexistence. I think interoperability is a theme that we see popping up everywhere, I'm sure you do, between these different currencies. But I think I really think that the uptick in interest in the US recently around CBDC has been driven by China.
You mentioned interoperability, and indeed that does crop up all the time, of course, between jurisdictions. Then you've also got between public and private. How should the public and private sectors collaborate in the development and deployment of CBDCs? This is potentially quite complicated, where there are concerns about one crowding the other out. How do they collaborate effectively, do you think, James?
Yeah, so this to me is, I think, one of the key questions here. The, you know, central bank's role really is, you know, fiscal policy and financial stability. They don't have, in most cases, they don't have a huge experience or capability in terms of things like onboarding clients and, you know, KYCing individuals and companies and so forth. So I think there's always been a role between, you know, central and private organizations. So I think the way it's most likely to roll out is that the central banks will sort of set the rules and provide a core platform for the creation of the CBDCs, the minting, if you like, and the distribution of them. And then I think the commercial banks and other financial institutions, other trusted financial institutions, will be part of the distribution model. So that's this sort of two-tier model that is talked about. I think that
in China, which the Chinese pilot does that, for example.
Right. Yeah, and I think every country is thinking along the same lines, right? So the commercial banks will do the onboarding of both businesses and consumers, but I think it needs to go a step beyond that. Right. I think if you look at where the innovation has come in the world, in the financial world recently, it's not come from the central banks or the commercial banks even. It's come from fintechs. So I think this private-public relationship needs to include beyond the sort of regulated entities that we think of today. So I think the way I would visualize it is, you know, central bank will provide the sort of core platform. Commercial banks will provide the sort of regulated, you know, way to engage businesses and people by onboarding them and checking out their credentials and so forth. But I think most of the innovation will come from the, you know, the fintech sector, I think that there will be probably dozens and dozens of use cases emerging over the next sort of 5 years that we haven't even thought of today, right? Particularly, I think, in the DeFi space, and I think in terms of, you know, P2P payments. I think it's going to provide an amazing platform for all that innovation. But it's going to ultimately, the central bank will still want control.
And there's also an interesting overlap between this area and how to create a tokenization that would support and enhance capital markets as well. That's the theme is running in parallel. Then we're exploring that at a later date. I mentioned earlier stable coins and the threat of them essentially propelling central banks, among other factors, into moving a bit faster on CBDCs. There's been a lot of debate about them in the US. You've mentioned that. Some want them banned in favor of CBDC. Others think they're a good idea because if you plug those into the existing system, you're not going to disrupt the banks too much, provided they're regulated like banks, for example. What do you think about stablecoins from the perspective of CBDCs? Will the future include one or the other, or possibly both of these systems?
My view is that they will include both. I actually think there will be a coexistence of CBDCs, stablecoins, and then, you know, native cryptos, you know, like XRP and Bitcoin. I think there's a role for all of them. I think specifically on stablecoins, there's definitely a trend towards looking at regulation. I think even just this past week, you know, in Japan, there was an announcement that the regulators are going to be looking at to regulate stablecoins in Japan, and potentially only, you know, registered banks and other registered financial institutions will be allowed to issue stablecoins. So, but I don't think all stablecoins are created equal, right? I think that, you know, they serve a purpose in the market. I think a stablecoin which is, you know, government sponsored, that is fully regulated, has a role to play and will probably be very attractive to some users. I think the private stablecoins, you know, also have a role to play, right? I mean, they're seen by some as, you know, more risky. They're not typically collateralized in the same way. And in fact, that's part of the work we're doing with Palau, is to say, you know, how interesting it would be is a government issued stablecoin that's fully regulated. How interesting could that be on the global market as opposed to, you know, some of the other private stablecoins that are not yet regulated. So I think there's room in the sort of, you know, in the playground for everyone, as it were. I think there's definitely concern about some of the current stablecoins. I think the European Central Bank in particular has been pretty concerned about, you know, the potential threat there. So regulation is definitely coming. It's inevitable.
One of the other factors that always comes up, and attitudes to it differ hugely depending on the jurisdiction, is the matter of anonymity and privacy, and reconciling that with supervision. How significant do you think, James, the tension is between anonymity and state surveillance as a barrier to issuing CBDC? We know that the ECB in particular is scratching their heads about this, not least because of Germany, where there's a very significant resistance to the idea that the state would know everything about all of your transactions when they don't know that about cash. Do you think that can be reconciled? You can get a system that works both for regulators and the broader financial ecosystem?
I hope so, is the answer to that one. I mean, I think we have to find a way through it. It's different in every country, which will make it interesting when you start doing cross-border CBDCs. You know, if you have a policy, for example, in Germany, where, you know, transactions below 100 euros are anonymized, but the policy in a different country is, you know, $200, you know, when you try and do a cross-border payment between one and the other, how does that work? I haven't quite figured that out yet. But I think it's a genuine concern. I think people are concerned about privacy. I think it's, in my personal view, right, I think it's a little bit become politicized and a little bit blown out of proportion. I think ultimately most people, particularly in developed countries, you know, use their credit cards for most things these days, right? And there's obviously information is captured. Now, whether that's used or not, that's a different question, right? But the notion of like having a central bank digital currency being used to spy on individuals I think is a little, I personally, I don't quite get it. I understand that's been a big topic in China. That, you know, and there's some people, some theories around that's the real motivation for doing it. I'm not convinced about that, but you know, I don't really know. But I think there's always a middle ground, right? And I think it'll come down to policy. It'll be, you know, for example, as I mentioned, you know, maybe transactions within a certain range are, you know, not captured or anonymized. You know, the individual citizens are going to have to trust that's the case, though, right? Because, you know, the data exists. So, you know, it's not as though you're not capturing the data. It's just you're saying you're not going to use it. So I don't know. It's a tough one. I think, as I said at the beginning, we have to find a way through it. If, you know, you can't let innovation and the world not progress just because of a topic like this. It has to be solved.
Yeah, it seems to go hand in hand, certainly in our experience, with places that still have very high cash use. You take a place like the jurisdiction where I'm sitting, the UK, cash has disappeared at great speed. Once you're in contactless payments, you're in the commercial bank regulatory arena already. So we're already there in many ways in those types of countries. Finally, James, it's been a very useful tour of all the key issues that keep coming up. But what do you think are the top three factors that governments and central banks need to get right for CBDCs to be successful in the end?
Yeah, I think there's more than three, but I'll try and get the top three. I think the policy side of things is crucial, right? At the end of the day, that has to be probably the number one, right? The central banks have got to balance their mission, you know, around financial stability with the reality in the world that, you know, the private sector has been innovating like crazy in the digital asset and digital money space. So I think getting that piece right is crucial. I think the tech is probably the second one. You know, there's a lot of talk about, do you need blockchain or not? You know, is a centralized system more efficient or not? I mean, if you have one use case and it's just, say, cash replacement, you can probably do that pretty well with a centralized system like in China. But if you want to provide a platform for innovation where these use cases that we, you know, some of the ones we talked about, you know, and other ones we haven't even dreamt of yet are going to be enabled, I think a distributed platform and the benefits that come along with blockchain, I think are, you know, and I would say that obviously, right, but I really genuinely think that is the way to go. So that has to be sort of put in balance with the tech. But I think where the rubber's going to hit the road at the end of the day is around adoption, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the policy could be set and the technology could be amazing and people might not use it, right? If individuals or businesses don't see value in using a digital currency, they won't use it and they won't adopt it, then the whole thing will just fizzle out. I think there's going to have to be some incentives, right? Some carrots, if you like, to get people to start using digital currency and start getting the you know, the ball rolling. Hopefully they don't have to be too much stick used, but hopefully it's more the incentives. And then when you look at some of the use cases, you know, like, you know, cross-border has becoming a bigger topic around central bank digital currency. You know, BIS have got their MCBC approach. You know, how do you resolve that? And I think, you know, this notion of a neutral bridge currency to be the building block, if you like, between different currencies, that's going to be something to balance as well. So I added a fourth one in there. I'm sorry, I sneaked an extra one in, but that's my view.
So I think in summary, CBDC is both very near and still quite far away, depending on which jurisdiction.
I'm always an optimist and I'm like thinking, yeah, we can do more quickly. But the reality is that, you know, processes and government decision making and, you know, takes time. I think there will, I absolutely believe that CBDCs will happen and there will be, you know, a lot of benefit to be had. And I think maybe to wrap up on my side, what we're trying to focus on is real money projects. I think if you look back over the last 3 years, there's been a lot of experimentation, as there should have been, right? That's the right thing to do. But I think now the tech is developed enough, there's been enough discussion around policy. So we're focusing efforts in, and I would recommend everyone else to do that, on real money projects, right? So make these things live in reality. And I think the more that can happen in some of the emerging countries, I think that will spur on the big countries to move a bit more quickly. And I think ultimately everyone will benefit.
I think that's exactly what's happening. So, James, great talking to you today. Thank you for that very fluent and clear tour around the key issues here. And looking forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you for joining us.
Well, John, it's been a real pleasure. And thank you for being a great host. And again, look forward to more discussions in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.